Welcome back to Crimes from the Peanut Gallery. I've decided I'm going to call my followers my fellow little peanuts. And here we are at episode 2 about Henry Lewis Wallace. This podcast covers true crime cases that may not be suitable for young listeners. There may be graphic or violent content. Listener discretion is advised. So guys, on episode 2, I think we'll be discussing the investigation, the arrest, the confession, the trial, and any other things that I could really find. So we're going to start with just some of the aftermath. The biggest issues that I've seen and I've read about is that it took so long to identify who the killer was. There was quite a lot of outrage from the families as well as the community, and rightly so. Specifically, Dee Sumter, who was Shauna Hawker's mum, she commented that the victims weren't prominent people with social economic status, they weren't special, and they were black. Deborah Slaughter's father actually said something vaguely familiar. It was perceived that it was due to the location of where the victims lived, the industry where they worked, specifically fast food, and in very basic terms, they weren't white. A retired police officer believed that the blame should lie with Sergeant Gary McFadden, given that Wallace should have been identified as a suspect as early as Caroline Love's murder. But I don't believe this to be true at all. He was appointed the head of the investigation so late in the game. Once he had been appointed, he met with all the families. He was trying at the very least to bring more attention to the situation, and he was making attempts to tie together any loose ends that he could find. His men interrogated any possible subjects with violent pasts who could move easily and unobserved throughout a black community. Detectives reopened contact with the families and friends of the dead girls, hoping to find a link between the victims. Not saying that they didn't have their failures, I'm just saying I don't think it's right to put all of the blame on one person. Perhaps they hung out at a particular place where they might have encountered a killer, perhaps they worked at one time together, or even attended the same school, or maybe they had all been befriended the same man, one individual with a criminal record. Nothing, as far as McFadden knew, was beyond the possibility. So how can you blame him when he was doing all of this in the background? I just don't understand. I think it lies with the whole entire department, and there was more than just one person to blame. I think there was also a mishandling of the profile from the FBI, so I think there needs to be some accountability there. In early 1994, the police department did reach out to them for assistance. Unfortunately, they mistakenly declared that the murders weren't the work of a serial killer. Typically, though, to be fair to the FBI, previously, serial killers were white who killed strangers. They really weren't in the African American community. It hadn't been highlighted into a profile yet. And even Robert Ressler, an FBI expert on serial killers, has been quoted saying in Wallace's defense, if he elected to become a serial killer, he was certainly going about it the wrong way. After the attempted murder of Brandy Henderson's baby, the police were really, really riled up. Sergeant McFadden and his squad put the pieces together on who they were after. Henry Lewis Wallace. His name had been associated with each of the victims in one way or another, through his sister, girlfriend, or his job at Taco Bell. After all those puzzle pieces came together, it was really all about finding him. They staked out his home at the Glen Hollow Apartments. Before all this, though, the police did speak with Wallace's girlfriend, Sadie McKnight. She was shocked and shook, but in somehow in all of this, she began to realise it was true and it made some serious sense. The horrible thing for her, the jewellery that he'd actually stolen from his victims and he hadn't pawned, he gave it to her. Imagine your shock at knowing you're wearing a dead woman's jewellery. I can't even imagine. Now, in defense of the police department, statistics from that period show that the department handled almost four times as many cases with African American victims, 237, as opposed to Caucasian, 60. The clearance rate for African American victims was slightly higher, with 84.8% to an 84% for the Caucasian, which according to the article in the Charlotte Observer was far above the national average for all cases. A direct quote from Price, was, if we didn't take out those cases seriously, I don't think our clearance rate would have been 84.8%. Race had nothing to do with it. You wanted to solve that case. It seems that even almost 30 years later, that the police department can't agree on two things. They can't agree on those things. What they can agree on is that they were understaffed and signs were missed. No wonder it took almost 4 years to arrest him for murder. Anyway, let's get back to Henry's arrest. While he was in custody, the police department discovered Deborah Slaughter. She earned the title of the luckless final victim. At around 5 p.m. on March 12, 1994, Wallace was arrested. For all the bravado that he'd shown in the last three murders, he came quietly and was compliant. There was not much of the hype that was expected of a man who had killed 11 women so callously. In fact, he seemed demure and not at all what they had expected. After Henry was arrested, he was taken to the Law Enforcement Centre, the LEC, L-E-C, where he was led into an interview room where he would detail out, over the course of 12 hours, his sick perversion to rape and murder. Darrell Price was one of the detectives to hear the confessions. But before we get into Wallace's confession, I'd like to share some comments and some thoughts from Darrell Price. Now, I've previously mentioned him quoting that race didn't have an issue to do with this, but we're going to explore this a little bit more. He disputes the reason that race was a factor as to why they were unable to catch Henry. I don't want to sound too sarcastic in this moment, but it seems like a pretty standard response from a police officer who's white. And again, I'm not trying to be controversial here. I'm just giving you my thoughts. He did acknowledge that there were errors and weaknesses in the department. These have been identified and changed, but it has changed the way the department solves crimes as a result. But 11 people dying shouldn't result in you being more careful. He also commented that the homicide department was massively understaffed and that things were missed as a result and that they did fail to connect the dots. Once they had Henry in custody, they actually asked him if he knew why he was there. He was very vague and he did allude to his warrant for failing to appear in court. After his Miranda rights had been read to him at about 10 p.m., there was a lot of back and forth between Darrell Price and Mark Corwin. How are your fingerprints on Betty's car? Why does your photo appear on an ATM trying to get money out from Vanessa Mack's account? Price then asked him, don't you think it's funny that how many people are dead around you and have unnatural causes? He was asked if he objected to the detectives recording and taping the interview. They needed to ensure that Henry couldn't come back during his trial and say that he'd been coerced into a confession to 11 victims, two of which police had no idea that he was connected to or linked. I'm just going to take a brief pause there, guys, and take a drink. Now, during the back and forth conversations and discussions, Henry inadvertently said that he knew another detective, Tony Rice, who had handled the disappearance of Caroline Love, Henry's third victim. This led to a call going out to Detective Rice, who was the one that was able to break Wallace finally. Around 5 a.m., almost 12 hours since Henry had been arrested, Rice entered the room, asked all those who were present to bow their heads and give a prayer. While holding Wallace's left hand, the detective led a prayer about thanks and repentance, guidance and forgiveness, and that's where Wallace began to cry. Rice told Wallace that it was time to cleanse his soul and tell the truth, no matter what. After a moment and an amen, Wallace sighed. Let's do it this way, he said, reaching for a pen and pad. Then Wallace began jotting down names. The detectives expected the list to begin and end with the four killings over the past 3 weeks. Wallace confessed to 10 murders in Charlotte, with his first being Tushanda in Barnwell, South Carolina. So that was 11 victims in total, 10 in Charlotte, one in South Carolina. All his victims in Charlotte were black women aged between 18 and 33, with Sharon Nance being the eldest of his victims. She was the only victim that Wallace didn't know personally. I find this probably the hardest pill to swallow, as he knew most of those women. He murdered. They never knew what evil was behind his eyes. The confession tapes are almost 10 hours long. That's a long time to hear some gory details of his murderous rampage he brought to the door of Charlotte. He callously shared the details of the victims, how some fought, scratched, punched, bit him, while others just purely begged for their life and mere mercy. He killed them, despite this. He even said that he considered almost all of them friends. Henry mentions in his confession that the ghosts of the victims speak to him through his dreams. Whilst it may seem like his goal initially with his victims was robbery to feed that drug habit, it really wasn't. He bragged how he enjoyed using the professional wrestling move known as the Boston chokehold to overpower his victims. The underlying behind it all was sex, rape. His sick perversions that started in childhood, that grew throughout his teenage years. It also came out during his confession that he had a stash of pornographic magazines during these years that had things like sexual restraints, the swing, knockout pills, and all those types of things. Leading the interview was Sergeant Patrick Sanders, who, according to the Charlotte Observer, is known for remaining calm and logical. His rough skin face is open and kind, and his soft frame is very non-threatening. I think this would have allowed Henry to feel safe and open up about his crimes, and it just would have given him a safe space, right? Because that's what they want. They want their suspects to feel like it's safe to talk. And I think that you're going to get the most truthful answers with that kind of environment. The other Charlotte Mecklenburg homicide detectives who were there during the confession, taking turns, was Gary McFadden, Darryl Price, William Ward, Mark Corwin, Anthony Rice, and C.E. Booth. Henry also mentioned during his confession that he honestly believed that there was another Henry who he would refer to as Bad Henry, further fragmenting his perception of himself. The good Henry and the bad Henry, creating a persona that allowed him to act out those fantasies and what he always desired to do. He said as he got older and as the years progressed, Bad Henry took over. His confession gave a lot of insight into who Henry was. He even spoke of his marriage, in which he said that, "I think other than a mate, I was looking for a mum as well as a trace of a mother," with his ex-wife, and how it was complicated sexually. She'd been raped, and this would upset Henry and also frustrate him towards her. In his words, he said, "She told me that when we had sex, it reminded me of the rape." Soon after the marriage started, his sexual fantasies were getting darker, and he wanted to experiment those out on his wife. She refused, and that soon ended their sexual relationship. Shortly after the marriage had begun to break down is when he began raping prostitutes, according to his confession. He said that during those rapes, he visualized being with his wife. This is already creating some pretty sick perversions already. After his wife left him without any warning, according to Henry, Henry began to stalk her. He made a plan to rape and murder her, as he knew she would let him in the house. Thankfully for her, that opportunity never arose, so he wasn't able to fulfill that fantasy. Once the killing began, he mentioned that there was no outlet previously for his childhood trauma or his marriage failure. But once Bad Henry took over, he was stronger and he was able to cope with all of that pain. And all that pain just went away. So he just let Bad Henry make all of those decisions. With the confession coming to an end, Sanders actually asked Henry Wallace, "Why have you told Why have you told us what you've told us today? I've wanted to tell my story for a long time, Wallace responded. If I wouldn't have told you, if I wouldn't have stopped, the killing would have continued, and probably I would have killed myself as well. I've tried many times, but was unsuccessful. Over the next coming weeks, the detectives would follow up on Wallace's claims of names, dates, and times. They went with him to the spot where he claimed Caroline Love had been left. They found her remains. Sullivan, the medical examiner, was able to confirm that Love had been strangled. On April 4th, 1994, Wallace was officially indicted with 9 counts of murder, as well as a battalion of other charges and various counts of first and second degree rape, various counts of first and second degree sexual offence, and various accounts with a deadly weapon, assault of a child under the age of 12, and several counts of robbery with a dangerous weapon. Aftermath of the arrest and the confession, there was a request from Charlotte's National Organisation of Women to investigate the police department. Whether the problem is economic, racial, procedural, or managerial, this issue must be resolved so that charlatanians can feel complete confidence in the law enforcement's ability to deal fairly and effectively with crime. Now, I'm just going to pause again just for a short. We're moving on to the trial now. As I'd predicted earlier, Henry claimed, 8 months after his confession, that it had been coerced. Given that the court needed time to review a claim such as this, his original trial date was postponed. His main argument was that he was not administered the Miranda rights until 10 p.m, almost 5 hours after his arrest. This was not the only argument he brought to the court. He also alleged that he'd been induced to confessing by a promise from the detectives to let him visit with his daughter Kendra and his girlfriend Sadie McKnight. And finally, it was regarding the delay to present him to the magistrate. Let's discuss that first argument, the Miranda rights. Now, according to the published court report, after Wallace was arrested, he was taken to the law enforcement centre. The police discussed with him why he thought he was there, his previous crimes, and his drug habits, and what he was doing around the time of the murders. They didn't allude to the victims. It was more of his whereabouts and what he was doing at that time. I don't know if that crosses the line, but I wouldn't think if you're not mentioning a victim that that's not really eliciting a response that you want. Now, when detectives felt there was a sufficient amount of doubt and also enough to justify a charge, it was only at that time that they read him the Miranda rights and charged him. This was well before the taped confession, which Henry said that he did understand his rights and waived them. The report also highlights that Henry was offered food and drink, allowed to take breaths if he needed to rest. He was not abused or threatened in any such way that he would fear for his safety or others until he confessed. I think a little bit from what I've read, it did seem like Wallace needed to talk, and he jumped at the chance, and it was more of after the prayer with Officer Rice that he unburdened himself. And he even said words similar to the effect after he confessed, "I wanted to tell my story." I'm really not sure that that sounds like a man who was forced to say anything, but we can never be really sure what goes on behind closed doors. And to be fair to all the judicial system on both sides, so suspects and the police department, you really don't know what goes on. Now, the second motion that he appealed was regarding that he was promised from the detectives to let him visit with his daughter Kendra and his girlfriend. However, I'm a little bit doubtful on this one, okay, guys? I'm not sure where his thought process was that he'd want to see his partner or let his child see him after confessing to the murders of those young women. But at the same time, I guess you know you're going away for a long time, so wouldn't that make you want to see your child? So I do sort of understand that. The detectives also stated that Henry didn't bring his child or girlfriend up until after he'd confessed. So I ask myself, how are you forced to talk when you weren't even thinking of them until after you confessed? Now, I am going to read a small transcript of the recording from the confession tapes. Officer Sanders, has anyone threatened you? Wallace, no. Sanders, coerced you or made you any special promises? Wallace, no. I just want an opportunity to maybe for the last time hold my daughter. I'd like to say goodbye to Sadie. I really can't speak with my family right now. I think I've caused them enough problems in my lifetime. My mother did the best job she could to raise me. Sanders, you've asked, and I want to clarify that you've asked to see if we can arrange for you to see Sadie and your daughter, and that we've said we will try and do that. Wallace, yes. Sanders, but aside from that, was that an exchange for you talking to us? Wallace, was that an exchange? Sanders, yes. Wallace, it was a condition. I wouldn't necessarily say it was an exchange. I wanted, like I said, for the last time to say goodbye to those people. Sanders, do you feel like we've used that to get you to talk to us? Wallace, no. No, I mean, I hope not anyway. I mean, I don't feel that way. Reading through that, there is some concern for me because I'm not sure he actually understood the questions. So I'm not sure whether that pertains for me that that's a good exchange. But I'm going to choose to believe and say that he really did understand it. Now, lastly, the alleged charge was around the delay in getting Wallace in front of a magistrate. Now, he was brought before the magistrate, Karen Johnson, around noon on March 13th, the morning after his confession and arrest. Wallace argued that if he'd been brought before a magistrate sooner, he would have not felt forced to confess. The police responded to this claim by saying that the defendant needed time to sleep, which he actually did between 7:30 and almost noon, and that transcripts of the confession needed to be made. Given that after he appeared before the magistrate, he continued discussing the murders openly and without hesitation, it doesn't really feel like to me that Henry's being completely truthful here. So, the result of the hearing, as recorded, is 1. Wallace had been given the Miranda rights in due and proper time. 2. That he made his confession voluntarily without any trickery from the police. And 3. That the delay in bringing him before a magistrate was not based off any offhanded motivation by the police. So that failed. So the trial began in September 1996, after nearly 2 years since his arrest. It was delayed due to a number of different things. There was a holdup of the choice of venue, DNA evidence from the murdered victims, and jury selection. Now, the trial lasted just under 4 months, and it was the largest murder trial that North Carolina had encountered with this number of victims. The charges were read as 9 counts of first-degree murder, 8 counts of first-degree rape, and 10 other crimes. There wasn't much information on those 10 other crimes, I do apologize. The prosecution asked for the death penalty with regards to Sharon, so it never went before a jury. Tashanda was unfortunately likewise. He was charged but never prosecuted. Leading the prosecution was Anne Tompkins. She was known to be tough, but a firm believer in the truth. She even told her staff before the trial, "Our ethical obligation is to justice, not necessarily to get a win." The prosecution took just over 6 months to prepare for the trial. I would say it probably took a lot longer. 400 exhibits were shown, with a long line of officials who talked about the fingerprints on the automobile and who played back over 7 hours of Wallace's confession, and who recalled Brandy Henderson's 10-month-old boy who was almost strangled to death, and who described in detail the ghastly expressions of the dead girl's faces. Imagine hearing the appalling way those women died and having to decide the fate of that man. I don't know if I could be fair and just. I'll be really clear on that. I'm not sure I could be. Now, leading the defense was Isabel Day. She was known for her kindness and somewhat of a little bit of a hero. It wasn't unusual for her to provide money to her clients if they needed it. The strategy for the defence was initially to get the confession thrown out. Well, that didn't happen. So it was actually next to cast doubt on Henry's sanity. They claimed that their client's mental illness and trauma from his childhood kept him from deliberately killing those women, forming the required intent for first-degree murder. No premeditation means no first-degree murder either. They brought in two very strong witnesses, Robert Ressler from the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit and a Dr. Anne W. Burgess, a specialist in psychosocial development. Ressler testified that he believed the defendant's actions displayed both organisational and disorganisational characteristics, which meant that Wallace exhibited signs of psychological instability. Burgess believed that Henry was unable to separate reality from fantasy, thus suffering from a mental illness. Now, on January 7th, 1997, just under 3 years before his arrest, Wallace was convicted of 9 murders. 3 weeks later, that same jury sentenced him to death. The judge, Robert Johnston's declaration, Judge Robert Johnston's declaration of 9 deaths included the punishment of penalties for rape and the multiplicity of the other charges for which he was convicted. I'm not sure, and I'm not opposed to the death penalty, but I don't think it solves anything for me personally. Now, again, this is just my personal opinion, guys. You don't have to agree. You don't have to disagree with me. I'm just saying that I don't think it brings the victims back, but I do think for those victims' families that there needs to be some course of justice. Now, I think more than anything for those families, it's needed. So I do understand and I completely get it. However, Henry did not go on to death row lightly. He would actually, after the trial ended, file another appeal. There were several reasons for filing the appeal, including the court's refusal to change the venue. He brought up his confession once again and the infection of the jury pool. The change of venue argument was discussed at length before the trial. It was determined by the court that enough time had passed, the media coverage was neutral and didn't favour one side or the other. The appeal outcome stated, although the evidence of pretrial publicity, most of which was favourable to the defendant or factually neutral, was substantial at the time of the defendant's motion, we cannot say that the trial court abused its discretion in recognising facts which ultimately may have impacted whether the environment for the defendant's trial was prejudicial. Now, I do understand where he's coming from with this. I'm not sure if I was in East Charlotte and I'd heard about these murders and I knew about them, that I sort of wouldn't be a bit predisposed, right, to you're guilty. I've seen what's on TV. But then again, they're saying that the media was quite neutral. So, or what if I thought, and I like to think that I'm a fairly reasonable person, what if I thought that he possibly had a mental illness? Because surely a sane person doesn't do what he does to people he knows. Because that doesn't really make sense to me. Like, surely there has to be something wrong with him. But that's just me. Now, these appeals would actually prove to be futile, as they were all rejected and Wallace would continue to be on death row. Now, I'm going to be quoting the North Carolina Supreme Court. We conclude the defendant received a fair trial and capital sentencing proceeding, free from judicial error and the sentences of death recommended by the jury and entered by the trial court are not disappropriate. No error. The legal battle to save Wallace has already been through the state and the federal courts. The North Carolina Supreme Court upheld the death sentences in 2000 and the US Supreme Court in 2001 denied his appeal. Now, in 2005, Superior Court Judge Charles Lamb rejected his latest appeal, but no doubt that Lamb's rejection is the first in a second round of appeals that will likely wind through the state and federal courts in the next few years. Now, that was back in 2005. So for a man who claims that everything, that his confessions were coerced, He does really like to continue talking. He's admitted he's killed more than 11 women that he's been charged for. And the criminal justice professor, Costin, commented, after his incarceration, he told authorities of others, if all true, the estimated numbers nears 20, all murdered across the world while he was on naval duty in various ports of call. Maybe he enjoys the spotlight and just doesn't want to be forgotten. I don't really know. Henry married Rebecca in 1998 and continues to stay on death row, where he's put on about 200 pounds and doesn't really do a whole lot. I'm just happy he's behind bars where he can no longer hurt women. Thank you so much for listening to my part two of Henry Lewis Wallace. Be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel, and comments are more than welcome. Enjoy, my fellow peanut true crime buffs. Thank you.